So much of what we have nowadays is the disconnect between the farmer and the diner. We also know what grew well in 1841, and we may not grow these anymore. The summary of all this is I had a dozen farmers growing 23 different plants and bringing me stuff that we know has not been eaten in generations, if not more. I just wanted to open a restaurant. You know, yeah. How did I get myself into this?
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, when we talk about farm to table, oftentimes people are thinking of that connection between the farm and the restaurant. Well, my guest today is in that spot where he not only has a restaurant that appreciates and has a relationship with farms, but he's also taking an interest in the heritage of the place where the land, where it's grown, and in the area that he is. And that area is in the heart of the country in St. Louis, Missouri. And he's got a lot of focus. I'm going to have him explain today on the Ozarks, but I am really happy that he's here with today. The only thing that would be better is Rob Connolly with Bull Rush Restaurant. Rob, it'd be better if I could come to your restaurant. I don't know when I'm going to do this again. I'm in Sacramento and you're in St. Louis, and I've been reading and hearing about what you're doing at Bull Rush Restaurant in St. Louis, and I think, this is what I miss. Maybe miss most in this whole pandemic age we've gone through in 2020 is I can't get on a plane and go somewhere and say, okay, we're in St. Louis. What are we going to do? I've been hearing great things about Rob Connolly's restaurant, and Rob, I want to come there sometime.
Well, it makes sense because we're half story and half food. And right now, people are mostly just getting the story, which I think is interesting myself, but story doesn't feed the belly.
You know what? Those are my two favorite things, though, story and food. And I think that's what Farm to Table Talk, the reason I started doing a podcast is that I like the whole food and farming connections and the stories about it. And people today want those stories. So when you have people come to your restaurant, they're coming for the food. You've got a great reputation. How do you share the story with them of what they're consuming and why they're consuming it and why it's on your menu?
Well, you know, we always have to talk now pre-COVID, post-COVID. The whole concept of the restaurant is we look at early 19th century Ozark foods and how my team and I can interpret that in contemporary styles and fashions. And when I say that, we're not looking at textbooks. All we do is look at letters and journals, firsthand documents from that time period, mostly found in different archives, where they're not describing in detail what their food was, but there'll be glimpses. You know, that maybe it's a guy writing back to his mom in Boston, here's what I hunted today, or here's what I traded with the Osage indigenous people. And we can take that and then use some, I like to talk about the concept of midrash. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's an ancient historic technique in Judaism where we have in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, we have documentation. And midrash bridges the gap between the different stories and the different characters, but it's not making up stories. It's informed storytelling. So we take what we know and build on it based on other things that we know. So we take that idea, and I look at these old documents, and I retell the story of these people from the past, but in very contemporary ways. Because at the end of the day, I'm a restaurant. I'm not an academic lecturer. And so I am getting to your answer, but the context becomes important because I'm trying to give voice to these people from the past. And the people from the past are the Osage Nation, the European-based settlers and immigrants, and the enslaved that also oftentimes came with them. to me, it's kind of an origin story. It's a contemporary origin story because the Osage were there long, long before then. But that point in time when the three cultures come together and first started interacting, that's when we create what we now know of as Ozark foods or Midwest foods or whatever definition you want to give it. Okay, so with that, when a customer comes and sits down, we are a very intimate dining experience. I'm in the center with my sous chef. People are seated immediately around us at a table height bar. It's only 24 people a night, and there are no servers. It's me handing you your food, me cleaning your dirty dishes. I do have someone to wash those dishes, but it's a very intimate experience. And so when I come up to you, this is pre-COVID, I tell you the story. I give you a, let's say, 2-minute explanation about what we're doing and why that dish even exists. Sometimes I'm talking about ingredients. Sometimes it's the forage. My team does all of our own foraging, so maybe it's what we found lately and how that ties to history. Sometimes it gets into more esoterica. We do a heritage pork project as one of our sub-projects. We do a historic seed project. We got a seed list from 1841. So we might talk about how that came to be and the research we're doing. Or sometimes it's just how I did my creative interpretation that led to the dish. But we do that as we hand you the food, and then we move on and give it to someone else. During COVID, because that's a lot of me splattering and blathering at people, but now I have a mask. Now we do a card that has a QR code, and guests are teased before they arrive to make sure they know how to use QR codes. They zap the QR, which takes them to a YouTube video of me describing that course and doing all those things I just mentioned. So they still get the storytelling, but now we've increased the safety of the experience.
Oh, man, that sounds exciting. Now, so the QR code, anyway, it's easier now for people to use QR codes. You used to have to download a scanner, but now about every smartphone, you just point your camera at it, and it takes you to wherever you want. And you're putting it up fresh for every weekly menu?
We do it every course. And so,
every course?
Oh, and because gosh. Our courses change every night, I'm doing a lot of videos each week. And we have to do that because forage happens very quickly, and it might be a very small batch. So a dish could last for days, maybe weeks, rarely over a month. But the other thing is these stories. If I gave you all, imagine how long we're about to talk right now.
Right.
If I were to do that to a customer in one fell swoop, I would lose them very quickly. They would be like, can I get my drink, please? Sure. So I give it to them in digestible amounts. And I try to keep them, 2 minutes seems about as much as they want to see me because, yes, we're a destination restaurant. Yes, they're coming to see me and eat the food. But really, they're here on their date. They're there for their anniversary, their birthday. They're there for a meal. And so I try not to make it about me or the restaurant or the story. It's about them, but part of the experience is just that, the storytelling.
You know, I think as you're saying that some of the best experiences I've had have been a few of the chef's tables in kitchens in a couple places. One of them I can't remember right now. It was in Washington, D.C. But it was so good that the chef would say, here, try this. And he'd bring it over, you taste it, and he'd say, okay, now, here, I want you to try that one with this wine. And I thought, this was like the best experience ever. And in fact, at the first one I experienced it, I had a chance to bring Jamie Oliver, the Naked Chef, on his first trip to the States. I met him at a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and we had that experience together. But
we love doing that. We love doing that. And especially for us, we love doing it with some of these the heritage seeds that have been grown for us this year, because those are flavors that people haven't had in generations. And then the other is forage. You know, a great example is pawpaw. A lot of people have heard the song of pawpaw down by the pawpaw patch. I don't even know the song, but people sing it to me all the time. So people know the the word. They know it's a fruit, but they don't know what it is. And so I'm able to go back into the kitchen and get some fresh pawpaw when it was in season and let them taste pawpaw and really solidify the concept for them.
You know, as we talk, I'm hearing acorns drop on my roof. I've got a large oak tree that's hovering over the top of my house, and acorns are dropping. Can I do anything with acorns? Is there something you can eat of an acorn?
Absolutely. And because you're over in California, you have some great acorns over there. I'm born and raised here, but I lived in New Mexico for a long time, and we had really great acorns in New Mexico too. Here, they take a lot more work to process, but you absolutely can. On my menu right now, I've got three different things made with acorn. The most popular is an acorn financier or financier. It's a rich brown butter bread with acorn flour. It's a unique flavor that people don't know. And if you were to just pick one up off the ground and pop it in your mouth, which you could and I could in New Mexico, but here in Missouri, it would be too tannic, too bitter. That would be off-putting. And that's why very often people say, oh, you can't eat acorns. They're poisonous. They're not poisonous at all. They're tannic. And those tannins are such that they can be washed away. And so, you know, the old-time method is you put your acorns, you take them out of the shell, put that meat in a burlap sack and throw it in the creek and let it run, let that water run for a week. More modern times, not at the restaurant, but more modern times, we take that bag, it's a mesh bag now, and we put it in the toilet tank. Not the bowl, but sure. The tank, because every time you flush it, you get a flush of fresh water that washes the tannins off. In more modern times, we do it stovetop. You can do a cold or a hot leach, where you change the water regularly until the water runs clear. Mm-hmm. For people like myself who do this for a living, we do hypermodern. So we have vacuum chamber sealers that boils water at a lower temp. And so we're able to do that stovetop process, which takes, let's say, an hour. We can do it in 4 to 7 minutes and not raise the temperature to a point that damages the acorns, which means it's not changing the flavor or the texture. And then we've got all that leached out. So regardless of which method you do, then all you have to do is grind it up, dehydrate it, and then you're good to go. You can make breads are the easiest thing. I do tortillas a lot with them.
Acorn tortillas. Oh, man.
Oh, they're the best. They're the best because it's earthy and it's got a little bit of bitterness, not in a bad way. In Korea, acorns are still eaten. The word is doto, D-O-T-O, and there's a dish called dotomaruk, and I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation of that. But dotomaruk is a savory acorn jelly. And so think jello made of acorns, and you dip it in soy sauce and eat it as a snack. It's more popular in the mountain regions, but it's still eaten very regularly today. The reason I know this is before I got good at foraging, I learned early on that I could go to a Korean grocery, sometimes a Japanese grocery, but always a Korean grocery, and they have acorn starch on their shelf. So people are still eating it.
Wow. Hey, you know, Rob, why don't we form the American Acorn Council?
Well, I'll tell you. So you're going down a road that I didn't know we were going to go down. There's I have the energy to do something about making people eat acorn, because why do we not eat one of the most prolific food sources in our country? Well, I can tell you, at least in part, and I think in large part, it's when the Europeans settled the Americas. To them, it was pig food. The indigenous people had, and still do, eat acorn. But there was a stigma placed on the eating of acorn back when mostly the Spanish were coming in, but also the other European settlers. And so this stigma is, it's dated, and it's counterproductive. And so I've wanted to do an acorn festival or some type of acorn event. And in fact, I've been watching, there's an event in Portugal that just happened well, it was scheduled to have happened a couple of weeks ago, that I wanted to go to because it was a chestnut acorn festival. And I wanted to see what they were doing on the acorn side, because it is unusual for people to eat acorns all around the world. I mentioned Korea, now I've mentioned Portugal, and I've been tracing down a liqueur in Italy, but I haven't found it yet. So it's there, and it's not just what I call the hippie set. It's not the, you know, the people who are scurrying through the woods. There are people for generations that have enjoyed acorns, and there's no reason that we should not. We know how to make it palatable. We just need to get that stigma off of them.
But on the other hand, it's good pig feed. I mean, you know, when you're talking about like Portugal and Spain, they got these crazy hairy pigs that are, you know, big long ears, and they look different than our pigs somehow. And they just like go out in these orchards and they're eating acorns. And that has to contribute to that really interesting flavor, in addition to the unusual fats. The lard is even different in these pigs that eat acorns. And I wouldn't be surprised if you get some chance at heritage pork that might even be grazing on acorns now.
Yeah, we work with a couple farms here in the area that do, they call it, I think, forest-grazed or forest-raised pork. And it's just that, you know, when they get to acorn season, that's what the pigs are eating.
Now, I am going to go pick up, as soon as I'm through this, I'm going to go sweep up the acorns I got that are bouncing all over my yard. and then I'm going to circle back with you sometime and have a trial run on fixing something, finding your instructions before we form the Acorn Council of the World. But, the, you know, Rob, give us an example. I want to come back and talk about where all these foods come from. But what might be on the menu now? Could you just pick like one entree and kind of walk through what might be on the plate, or the, and maybe even the salads or desserts or anything?
Yeah. We don't think as contrived may be the wrong word, but we don't think it's contrived in terms of soups and salads and entrees. It's here's some flavors and textures that we think go together. Our big heartier protein that we give people, because I'm in the Midwest, I need to give them a big chunk of meat at the end. Right now we're doing turkey thigh. The turkey is inspired by the hunting of wild turkeys. We're not doing wild turkeys because I don't have a source for that. But we're doing a confit turkey thigh. But what's really more interesting to us is it's topped with a Mexican mole. Now, Mexican mole has nothing to do with anything with the Ozarks, but all of the ingredients in that mole are foraged. And the predominant ingredient is pawpaw, which I've already mentioned. The spices include something called spice bush, which comes off kind of like black pepper, sassafras, shagbark, hickory, and hackberry. We've got a whole bunch of things in there because we don't season our food with anything but forage in general. I'm going to put an asterisk and say there are things that come in when needed, and then salt. But we don't, in general, use black pepper or other stuff like that, although, again, sometimes it creeps in. But in this mole, it's all foraged ingredients. And then that's all served on some more obvious characters. We have a Floriani grit that is on the base of the plate with foraged black trumpet mushrooms. And then hominy. We do our own hominy, meaning we take the dry corn, nixtamalize it, soak it, which is a number of different cycles of boiling to get it to puff up to what you would expect for hominy. But because ours is done in-house versus the canned stuff, which takes some chemicals, ours still has chew to it. I love pozole, but I love our hominy. And so the hominy, the grits, the mushrooms, the turkey, the mole. Oh, and then we do some seared Brussels sprouts with it, just because I love Brussels sprouts.
But they probably came from out here. A lot of them do, because I lived over at Santa Cruz, and that's where like 90% of the Brussels sprouts are grown in that area too. And I love Brussels sprouts, especially now.
Yeah, these are grown locally. There was a farmer that was able to grow them, and we grabbed every last one we could. We oftentimes say we're 100% locally sourced, asterisk, minus the sugar, salt, and fat. And we do pretty good on the sugar and fat. we actually could do fat very easily, but we serve a lot of vegetarians and vegans, so I can't use lard. Otherwise, I would. I mean, that would be very authentic to the period.
Some really good lard, especially with some of these unusual breeds and the way they're fed. What would you drink with this? I mean, do you serve a wine or an ale or anything?
Oh yeah. So we go down a lot of rabbit holes that were not expected when we opened. None of this was planned when we opened. We just wanted to do something that referenced the food of my childhood. And so with drinks, beers are easy. We have 54 breweries in the local metro area, and they're all really good. I mean, this is a beer town, and so we do that. We try to focus on the guys who are who do some foraged-related beers, and with one in particular, Earthbound Beer, we've done the foraging, sent them the forage, and then they brewed the beer. So those have been fun. On the wine side, this is a deep rabbit hole that makes my head spin sometimes. So what many people don't know is in the 1870s, almost all of Europe's wine culture was wiped out by the phylloxera epidemic. And so rootstock from the United States, in particular Missouri, because that's where there was an expert down in the Ozarks, was sending rootstock over to France from the Ozarks to rescue their vineyards. Mm-hmm. Well documented. Anyone in the wine history world knows this story. Ironically, American plants are what caused the epidemic. And then Missouri rootstock ended the epidemic because they were grafting on to this rootstock. There's a lot of discussion about the role of California in there, but the role of Missouri is very well established. What we're trying to do, because this is how our brains work, my whole team does this research, not just me, is we're trying to find right now, literally, the ports that those rootstock were shipped out of in the United States and or the ports where they were received in either northern Italy or France.
Yeah.
And if we can find that, which we will, then we can find the vineyards, which of course they won't exist anymore in their original names, but the vineyards that used Missouri rootstock. We have provinces and regions already, and there's some of the big boys, which is good for us. So we serve wine from Bordeaux, Burgundy, Languedoc. And of course, any wine that we serve is sustainable, biodynamic, all that stuff. But for us, the goal, and we're working with the archivist at the National Archive right now, is to get those shipping records. If I can get those shipping records, it moves beyond, well, here's wine from Burgundy, and here's why. It's a legitimate story, but to say we're buying from this vineyard because 150 years ago, that vineyard was rescued by Missouri rootstock.
Wow.
That's what we're serving on the wine side, which... it's a fun project that will never end because there's so much research out there. And then there's cocktails. We do a lot of craft cocktails. It's based on two things, forage or zero waste. We do a zero waste kitchen. We literally have under 5 gallons of food waste a week, and that food waste goes to a community garden's compost bin, so it's really zero waste. But if it composts to us, that's failure because we missed an opportunity. But there we make our own kombuchas, we make our own shrubs, we make our own misos, amino acids, water kefirs, on and on and on. All that stuff gets sent to the bar where they make drinks and goofy things like I don't let the bar people have lemons or limes because there weren't lemons and limes back then. Sure. But we know there was vinegar, and so I make a lot of really cool vinegars for them to use as souring agents.
You probably have distilleries, too, that produce locally.
Yeah, we do, and we use quite a few of them. I don't hold my bar back. If they want to buy booze, they can buy whatever they want.
Sure. Well, now, when you start looking back and all this research you're doing, it's so exciting. So what period are you? Are you talking antebellum, or is it the late 1800s?
No. In fact, we stop at 1870. So I used to say 1820 to 1870, and the only reason was the oldest document I laid my hands on was 1820. And 1870s are the industrial age. So during the 1870s, late 1860s, all of a sudden, I would see newspaper clippings from back east in these family scrapbooks. Or I would see the outside influence. And so it wasn't as interesting to me because it wasn't as pure of a an ideal at that time. But since then, I've developed a relationship with the Osage Nation, who's now in Oklahoma, and they have a director of historic preservation, Dr. Andrea Hunter. And Dr. Hunter's been sharing some of her work with me, and she's a paleoethnobotanist, which this is a whole other
goofy. Don't run across that every day.
I'm in the world of paleoethnobotanists. I have four of them who are in different projects working with us on this restaurant. I don't know how these things happen to me, but I do. So Dr. Hunter sent me her stuff, which is really early or late 18th century, back to the late 17th century. There's a point in time where it's hard for my customers to relate to the information. And a crystal clear example is another paleoethnobotanist from Washington University studies what she calls lost crops. Lost crops for her are very specific varietals of amaranth, knotweed, and another one. I'm forgetting the third one. And she's wanting to show that those are viable food sources because 3,000 years ago, she has fossilized evidence of those seeds being manipulated by human hands, meaning they were winnowed and consumed, which means they were cultivated. So she brought those seeds to me and we worked with them and I used them in my menus and I still do. That's an interesting story. It's an academic story. It's a harder story for me to sell to someone who's just coming in for dinner versus they can visualize the Osage Nation in the woods in the Ozarks, and certainly the settlers and the enslaved.
So probably, I'm guessing, is that like the 1850s or really a prime time?
Yeah,
because they,
absolutely.
The Native Americans were still there on their way out, and you were having people coming from the South and in some kinds of bringing slaves too into Missouri, all pre-Civil War. But
yes,
that seems... And in fact, I read Grant, you know, Ron Chernow's book, Grant, and he was, Grant's wife was from St. Louis. They had a farm just south of St. Louis. And in the book, they described some meals that they were having. And this was like in the 1850s. And it made me think about that, how cool that was, to restaurants pre-Bull Rush of that period. And it made me think back then about what... How rich that environment is in that Ozark area, and you were just reminding me you still have Native American customs there too before you had all these kind of transplanted plantations in a way that were shaping in St. Louis and that in the Missouri.
Yeah, and that farm is still here. It's called Grant's Farm, and you know, one of the interesting things that has come about with this research, and again, I didn't open this even knowing I was going to do this. But starting to see that the Ozarks are not the Ozarks. Of course they're not. Appalachia is not just Appalachia. There's a lot of diversity within there. And so a good example is the beginning of my research as I started getting serious about was pretty much exclusively in the mountainous interior of the Ozarks. I never saw a reference to the enslaved. And many of my on-the-ground contacts, people who have family ties going back into the mid and early 1800s, they would say, that's just not something that is part of our culture here. We don't think in those terms. And in fact, one told me, because his family is from a German ancestry that comes from indentured servitude, and they said, we were very much anti-slavery because of who we were.
Yeah.
Then as my research continued on and I got to the foothills of the Ozarks, where all of a sudden it's not wooded anymore. Now it's prairies or whatever fields, and it's able to be farmed and plantations are able to be created, you know, plantations down south up on the northern side. They don't call them plantations. They're just farms. all of a sudden, then we start to see the enslaved showing up in the records. The interesting thing for the astute listener here is the enslaved in the Osage, there's not recorded documentation, right? Or if there is, it's coming from the white man's perspective. And so that's oral tradition that's been passed down.
I don't think of anything that kind of transitioned into becoming like regular food, or that I would think I would go to a restaurant and say, well, this is something that Native Americans used to eat, where you might have collard greens and other things and catfish and so forth that seem to have a Southern heritage, but not Native American foods. Am I missing something? Was there some that survived and transitioned that I don't know about?
No, I think that's accurate. Of course, Three Sisters and corn and squash come into the lexicon, and we have records from Cahokia Mounds, which is an indigenous settlement just across the river from St. Louis. So we know that 1,000 years ago, those things were being grown, because there are people who are much more versed than I in talking about when those ingredients were being brought to the continent, or are they indigenous ingredients, native ingredients that have been cultivated into what we know of them now. I'm certainly not the one to have that conversation. So we know, though, that those ingredients exist in our diets, but the idea of Three Sisters doesn't really stay in the lexicon. We could talk succotash. Okay, is that a derivative? But it's not as direct as what you're asking. And I think that's why there's the movement right now with a number of indigenous chefs, whether it be the Sioux chefs, Stan Sherman up in Minnesota, or Neffy Craig over on the Navajo reservation in Arizona. I mean, there are people who are saying, let's save this for our own people, save that culture, and two, let's let the world know that this is an important part of the history of this country.
I love what you're doing. Now, I'm wondering, though, are you creating a supply source for these things? I mean, some of it you're actually foraging, and you're foraging and you're finding what you're utilizing, and that seems a story in itself. But what about, are you having any influence on the farms that are either growing certain breeds or certain crops because you've inspired them to start producing what's these unique things?
I can only chuckle because, again, I just wanted to open a restaurant. You know, how did I get myself into this? So last November, the archivist for the St. Louis Gateway Arch Museum, who's a federal archivist, had eaten at my restaurant, kind of fell in love with the project, and invited me to the St. Louis chapter of the National Archivist Association monthly meeting. So I went, and chefs are busy. So I, to be honest, I was like, not sure I wanted to waste my time at this. Like, I saw there could be potential value, but I show up. I'm not a shy person, but when I don't know anyone else and everyone else knows each other, I can be kind of quiet. So I went in, they're all eating their gross grocery store cookies and tea. And I just went and sat down, and this guy came over and sat next to me, an old guy, I'd say, I don't know. Anyway, older than me. And he introduced himself. And he said, his name, and he said, I'm the archivist at the City of St. Louis Recorder of Deeds office. And being completely honest, in my mind, I thought, oh, great, I got the most boring archivist in the entire city sitting next to me. Because I couldn't even fathom what that could be that would be of interest. I now know it's actually really fascinating stuff because he does the marriage records, the death records, all that stuff, in addition to all other legal proceedings. But at the time, I didn't know that. And so I introduced myself, gave the elevator pitch of what we do here, and his eyes lit up. And he said, I didn't know why I felt compelled to sit next to you, but now I know. I have something you want, and I need you to come to my office immediately so I can show it to you. What he had just recently discovered down in their vault a legal document from 1841 from a seed store in St. Louis that had gone belly up. And because of that, they listed the inventory of the seed store. Now, pause the story. I didn't know there were seed stores back in 1841, but apparently there were, and quite a few. And so then back to the story, I said, oh, so it says like tomatoes, cucumbers, whatever. He said, no, it lists the 12 types of tomatoes, the 20 types of cucumbers. And now my eyes lit up. This was the holy grail for me, right? Because he's talking my time period, my region, and his specific things. So we made plans. I went down there, and I couldn't handle the document, which I normally get to do. And he made copies of it, brought it to me. Like with so many of these old documents, they're faded. They're hard to read. It's old-timey, beautiful script. So I've learned to use my cell phone and take a picture and apply the different filters to make the contrast more vibrant so I can read these things. And then I use my network of friends to help me decipher, to figure, because like think of S's and F's and what they look like back then. There's a lot of similarities. So we go through all this and he gives it to me. There's 95 seeds listed. Of the 95, I put them in a spreadsheet right away. 70 are still available commonly. You can go to Burpee even and find them. Of the remaining 25, which those are the ones I'm curious about, right? I go through and 23, we were able to get 23 of those seeds by a partnership with Seed Saver Exchange up in Iowa and Baker's Creek Rare Seeds down in Mansfield, Missouri. Mansfield's in the Ozarks, so that was fun. And both of those seeds suppliers were very excited about what I had found. So, of course, I shared it with them. And then they started digging through their vaults and found even more seeds that had Ozark historic connections. And for them, they always have the story like, well, this is from the Smith family, and they document that great-great-grandmother grew it for generations in this town and whatever. And so they provided me with stuff. So the summary of all this is I had a dozen farmers growing 23 different plants for me this past year. This was our first year. And bringing me stuff that we know has not been eaten in generations, if not more. Good example, one of my favorites. We got something called the ice cream watermelon. If you Google it, you'll be able to maybe find some seeds. 2 years ago, I found them. Last year, I couldn't. And anyway, we were able to get some for the season. We, with all these old seeds, we know there's a reason that they are no longer available. It's either they weren't pest resistant, the environment isn't conducive to them, or they fell out of fashion. The watermelon is the latter, I believe, because it grew great. But there's a ton of seeds in there. In 2019, 2020, people don't want seeds in their watermelon. They want seedless. But the thing is, it is the sweetest, most delicious watermelon I've ever had in my life. And so these things, one, the farmers are excited about this. It's creating flavor diversity. It's creating biodiversity. And they're not committing a lot of land to it because there's too much risk, right? We know that these stop being grown. Why? We don't know. And so they can't commit too much acreage. But once they do and they realize I'm going to pay premium prices for whatever they get out of the ground, then it opens up some more doors. And we're already planning for next year, obviously, because farmers are doing that. But on my end as a chef, I remind them, I don't care if it's ugly. I don't care if it grew to the size that you would expect to be the plant to grow to. I don't care about those things because I'm going to process the food. I'm a chef. I'm not going to put a carrot on your plate and charge you $20. No, I'm going to make something with that carrot. And so like the watermelon, right now we're doing a venison pate, and it's topped with the watermelon that we reduced. We didn't add anything to it. Except we put some chili peppers in there, and we reduce that liquid down until the natural sugars concentrated to a point that it's a jelly. And so it's a slightly spicy, slightly smoky, because we smoked the chilies first, watermelon jelly, but it doesn't taste so much like watermelon as concentrated natural sugars. And so that goes on top of the pate, a little bit of rye bread, 100% rye, and pickled amaranth seeds. That's our nod back to that Lost Crops project. And I don't remember, there's something else. I'd have to ask my sous chef what else he's put on that course. But that's what we're doing. And we want to make sure the consumer, the guest, knows all that story in a much briefer format of what they're eating. And we want the farmers to have the bigger picture of the history and the modern diner and what their role is in that. And then when I talk to the universe, to media or whatever, I make sure they see that connection, because so much of what we have nowadays is the disconnect between the farmer and the diner. We miss all the steps in the middle.
Wow.
And so there's not an appreciation for what the farmer went through. Like, people don't care that this historic turnip that one of my farmers, Stan Williams, grew for me, his spring crop, every one of them rotted. I bought what he had. His fall crop worked, but he lost revenue on that spring crop. The consumer doesn't care, but they need to care. They don't need to do anything necessarily, but they need to know that that is part of the reality. That if a crop floods, well, that farmer's out of luck. So there's a lot more thinking that goes on about this. But at the end of the day, again, I was just trying to open a restaurant.
You know, though, I bet your farmers are an interesting crowd. I'd like to meet some of them, because it's different than a farmer that necessarily is going to go out and buy a $600,000 tractor and $1 million combine. Yeah. They have to commit to have almost a similar level of curiosity. I'm sure they end up getting more per pound or per unit than they would if they were producing a commodity, a large scale commodity. But it's probably not enough to compensate for the extra time and effort and energy to be able to, you know, to produce all of these. They have to love it themselves.
Yeah. I've got a lot of geeky type people, nerdy type people in my universe, and the farmers are certainly in that set, because I don't think any of them brought me enough that they got more than, let's say, $500 this season. You know, mm-hmm. I'm nothing to them, but they see, one, the curiosity, and two, I think they see the potential. I think about tomatoes. Man, growing up, I mean, you know, I'm 52. When I was growing up, I remember a lot more varieties of tomatoes that were being naturally grown on the vine, not a hothouse and not industrial. I'm not knocking these other things. I'm talking about flavor and texture. And now, in one way, there's more, but it seems like when I go to the farmer's market, there's less, because everyone's doing the same stuff. And they're doing the same stuff because the ecology, the geography of your region is similar. So we know that these tomatoes grow well here, and the word gets around to the other farmers, and so everyone grows them. But what's cool about this historic seed project is we also know what grew well in 1841. And we may not grow these anymore.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to have some more conversations sometime, because I really appreciate this. Now, a couple of things. You've written a book, have you not?
Yeah, I guess it's been about 5 years ago now. I wrote Acorns and Cattails, which is a modern foraging cookbook of forest, farm, and field, and a lot of alliteration. I was trying to capture the meals I was creating back in New Mexico. All the recipes are intended for people all over the country, and all the foraged items should be accessible all over the country. I worked really hard to ensure that and show online options and substitutions and whatnot. But it's meant to be a window into the creations we were doing. So I always tell people, don't buy it to learn how to forage. I have a section on how to forage, but it's very minimal. There are much better books than that. And it's definitely not meant to be your quick meal at home. You know, everything's doable, but we were a fine dining restaurant. And so I was trying to show people what that looked like.
Well, I am so impressed with what you're doing, and I'm envious, and I'm also jealous that those people in St. Louis that have an opportunity that I don't for a while to come try out the Bulrush restaurant. if people want to find you, where do they look for information about the Bulrush restaurant and some of these other things that you've been talking about today?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing is go to our website, which is bulrushstl.com. And Bulrush is one L. And for people who don't know, Bulrush is a cattail. It's the European word for a cattail. And I serve a lot of cattails in the spring, which is why we named the restaurant
that. Cattail?
Yeah.
You eat them?
Oh, yeah. Of course you do.
I didn't know that. I just thought you just had them stick them in a vase with some.
You know, well, and remember, my cookbook's called Acorns and Cattails. And it's because those are the two ingredients I serve more than any other forage. Yeah. Oh, so it's Bulrush STL. And we have a media page there where we try to link the stories and the interviews that capture some of these bigger things. Mm-hmm. You know, not the things like Chef Rob's favorite pie recipes, which we love those too. But the stories that allow us to tell these deeper stories through the media are all linked in there. And there's just some really cool stuff that we've been able to articulate this year, which we hadn't been able to before. And, you know, I'm so appreciative because this brain can only hold so much, and it's nice when we're able to get this and documented, one, because it's cool, but two, I think it's going to inspire other people. It's like, why do you open a restaurant? There's always going to be people who open restaurants because they just want to pay the bills and have a livelihood. That's fine. But there's also people I know, because they reach out to me regularly, who are trying to do something bigger, something more lasting, something that has an impact on their community, on their family, on their history. And so getting that stuff documented for people to read is really exciting for me.
Well, and we're getting them documented on a podcast too. There's so many interesting takeaways. And one I'm still thinking about is how you're able to do a QR code for the menu coming up so that people see the story in advance. And I've had a lot of stories. You're the first one that I know that has used a QR code like that to be able to take some of the ingredients in the upcoming menu that people are going to come and enjoy so that they can look up the story of the ingredient of the foods that they're going to enjoy that night.
Yeah, your listeners can watch those videos. All they have to do is go to YouTube and search for Bulrush St. Louis Restaurant, and they'll find our page. We don't have them locked up. And one of the interesting things about this is we don't have recipes. We don't keep record of what we've served. But because of these videos, now I'm having to document them. And I think it's going to be really good because it's going to provide a chronologic history of what we've served through COVID, and we'll see if we do it after COVID.
Oh man, I tell you, I'm going to check those things out too right now. I am so hungry. I don't know what I'm going to do first, go eat something or go out and pick up my acorns. I really want to thank you, Rob Connolly with Bulrush Restaurant in St. Louis. You're doing some really, really creative things. And again, I'm a little jealous of those folks that get to go try it firsthand. Someday I'm coming, Rob. I'll be back there when we're traveling again. I'll be back in St. Louis and look forward to having this conversation while we enjoy some of this wonderful Ozark cuisine. Rob Connolly, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much for letting me tell my story.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.